Good morning. Well, I'd like to welcome you to the Center for Insurance Policy and Research Terrorism Brunch. I've been taking a lot of hits on calling it that. People are asking, terrorism brunch? That doesn't sound like something I'd ever want to go to. In fact, we were joking about what we might have put in the food. Bad joke. Okay. Well, I thought we'd keep it a little bit light. I mean, I know it's a terribly serious topic, but if you look at our handout, we've got that cartoon bomb on there. We thought that's about as light as we can go because this is a topic that that is serious to us all. Has us all concerned, you know, and just simply looking at the day's events. Every morning I turn on the TV since I've been here, you got North Korea rattling sabers and moving missiles and making threats. You know, so this world is really a dangerous place. And we have, since our serious events of September 11th, we have, as a nation, come together in many ways, and we have implemented a terrorism risk insurance program, which is going to be kind of the main focus of our activities today. You might wonder why we're starting to talk about the Terrorism Risk Insurance Program this year when it's still got a year and a half to go before it actually expires. But our panelists will share with you their perspectives on why it's important that that we get the word out now as we move into the congressional voting on the bill, and there are some things that will happen if there's no action this year. We'll be talking about those. There'll be things that happen next year if there is no action, and we're hoping that a timely renewal would be the best outcome for us all. Now, these gentlemen that are up here before you, we think are perhaps the best panel that you will hear assembled to discuss terrorism and coverage for acts of terrorism here in this in the United States. I'm not going to go into and read all of their biographies. If I did that, we would take a half hour out of the festivities, and I think hearing from these gentlemen will be more interesting to you than listening to me read that. But I did want to say a little bit about each one of them. As there are particular reasons that they have been invited to participate in this panel. So today I'm joined by Michael Angelina, first left, stage left, your right. He's here representing the actuarial community. So he'll be helping us understand the uncertainty surrounding the pricing of terrorism risk and the insurer's appetite for providing coverage. So I think we'll hear some interesting things from Michael. Next to him is Tom Glasick. Tom's currently the general counsel for the District of Columbia Department of Insurance, Securities, and Banking. And he was serving as a member of the majority staff for the Financial Services Committee when the 2007 reauthorization bill was being considered. So he got considerable insight as he was the insurance expert to the House Financial Services Committee at the time. Next to Tom is Robert Gordon. Robert Gordon's currently a senior vice president for policy development and research at the Property Casualty Insurance Association of America. Before that, in his other life, he was a parliamentarian, senior counsel, and ethics compliance officer for the House Committee on Financial Services. He's been around since the initial terrorism risk insurance program and for both of its subsequent renewals. Next to Robert is Eric Gustafson. Eric is a vice president and director of government relations at Marsh & McLennan Companies. He's particularly studied insurers' appetites for terrorism risk in the U.S. and throughout the world and will provide us insights in those areas. And last but not least is Baird Wiebel. He serves as a specialist in financial economics for the Government and Finance Division of the Congressional Research Services. He's been involved in studying the Terrorism Risk Insurance Program since joining CRS. And in that handout is an interesting paper that Baird recently did It gives a great summary of the Terrorism Risk Insurance Program. There's a wonderful graph in there that in clear presentation form, tells you when and where the government will participate and where insurers will participate. And he's also got a table in there near the end of the document that compares the various versions of the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, the original one, the 2005 renewal, and the 2007 renewal. That document, I think, perhaps presents the clearest explanation of the Terrorism Risk Insurance Program that I've ever seen. So as we move into the presentations here, we plan to give you an appropriate balance on the background of the Act and discuss with you a variety of issues related to the insurability of terrorism risk. We'll start with some opening remarks from each of the speakers and in the following order. Baird will provide us a general overview of the program and some of the background information and things that he's discovered in studying the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act. And you will see that we're working from general down to more specific. He'll be followed by Robert Gordon presenting some of the particularly pertinent issues in today's world regarding that, followed by Tom Glasick, who will provide his perspectives on terrorism risk and the activities with a perspective from a state regulator. Eric Gustafson will talk to us about the appetite for risk, not only in this country, but worldwide, and some of the activities that Marsh and McLennan is involved in supporting the evaluation of terrorism risk insurance coverages. Followed by Mike Angelina, who will get down into the nitty-gritty of how difficult it is to price terrorism risk. We'll provide some perspectives, an actuarial perspective, on managing that risk and kind of serve as our cleanup batter before we go into a question and answer period where we hope to engage you in getting your questions asked and answered. Without further ado, we'll bring Baird up here for his presentation.
Well, I want to thank Eric for that introduction. Although I think saying something along the lines of the most intelligible that one can make the TRIA program may be damning with faint praise. But a couple things before we begin. As you said, my name is Baird Wable. I work at the Congressional Research Service. For any who aren't familiar with CRS, we are a division of the Library of Congress. We basically provide independent, nonpartisan research analysis for Congress on a wide, wide variety of topics. As such, the organization does not take positions on issues. I am not specifically representing the organization here today. And I would go further and say, if you hear an opinion out of my mouth today, it's entirely possible it's not actually my opinion. Because part of my job is basically to make sure the policymakers understand all sides of an issue. And so frequently I will bring things up even if I don't actually believe them. Anyway, that said, to talk a little bit about TRIA, I think the easiest way that I usually start explaining TRIA to people is to think of it as sort of a three-part program that for a small terrorism event, that it essentially leaves the losses in the private sector. For a sort of, quote, medium-sized terrorism event, the role is to sort of spread the losses from terrorism over time and across the insurance industry through government participation, which is then recouped after the fact. And for a large terrorism event, that you would basically have increased government share and pure government share, taxpayer share of the losses, although there is a possibility in the law that even in a very large event that you would have recoupment after the fact through basically premium assessments on insurance premiums going forward. So to talk about the way the program looks today, there is a minimum event size in the program of $5 million, so that if an event occurred that had less than $5 million in insured losses, it basically would not be considered for the program at all. There is a $100 million trigger for an annual trigger so that the before, even if you have a number of $5 million events, that would have to hit $100 million of multiple small events before the program would kick in. So that's, to go back to my original formulation, that's the sort of small, is essentially sub $100 million. Once you reach that trigger point, there is a 20% deductible for each individual insurer. Now, in the aggregate, if you look at the covered lines of insurance and aggregate 20% of the direct earned premiums, you get a number that's $34 billion. So conceivably, if the losses were spread equally across the entire industry, that 20% deductible could be, in the aggregate, a very high number. Of course, the odds of that happening is very, very small because of the you know, multiple insurers are only writing in individual states. So you would have some deductible amount between $100 million and $30 to $35 billion that would be absorbed by the private insurers. After this deductible is cleared, it's an 85-15 split, with 85% of it being covered by the government and 15% still being covered by the private insurers. And that goes up to a total of $100 billion in insured losses. And then basically over $100 billion, the program doesn't cover it and doesn't require the private insurers to cover it. So where is this sort of medium line stop between, say, the line between a medium event and a large event, quote-unquote large? At this point, it's basically $27.5 billion. So if the insured losses go up to $27.5 billion or is under $27.5 billion, a mandatory recoupment surcharge kicks in after the fact, and this would be basically added or applied by the Secretary of the Treasury in the years following the attack on property casualty insurance premiums until the government share was recouped by the government. Now, because of some of the interesting ways that the budget scoring is done in Washington, the way the law was written in 2007, this recoupment has to be finished by 2017, which you'll note is a 10-year window, because that's the way we score budget bills in Congress. And the amount that's actually going to be recouped is 133% of what the initial government share was. These provisions were not in the original law, or at least the 133% and the sort of time limit on when it had to be recouped were not in the original law. As I said, this was added really purely as a budget scoring issue to make sure that under the budget rules in Washington, the act did not actually did not cost money, which obviously it's always easier to pass something if it doesn't look like that you're having to spend money. In reality, of course, the actual cost of this program is pretty much going to be either zero or going to be a very large number. Because at this point, you have a handful of people that are administering the program in the Treasury Department. There have been no payments that have gone out to any insurers. There hasn't been no terrorist attack that met the criteria. If you do have a large terrorist attack that meet the criteria, obviously the number that could go out is very large. Once you go above that $27.5 billion number, there is no mandatory recoupment, but the Secretary of the Treasury does have the discretion to recoup, again, from the insurance industry, up to the entire amount, but that is up to the Secretary's discretion. As part of the law, there's a requirement that insurers offer terrorism coverage. What happened post 9/11 is we saw terrorism exclusions. Consumers reported difficulties in obtaining terrorism insurance or the impossibility of obtaining terrorism insurance. And there was a fear that this could result in slowdowns in commercial property development, loss of jobs in the wider economy. And so the Act stepped in to try to address that. Part of what it did to try to protect these consumers was require that the insurers offer the coverage, but it did not require the consumers to purchase the coverage. So you end up with situations, obviously, geographically and within particular industries, where the take-up rates and the amount of people that are actually purchasing the coverage vary dramatically. based obviously on the people's perception of whether or not they perceive of themselves as a terrorism target. In the history of the Act, as it's evolved over time, the direction has basically been for reduced government participation and increased private participation. It was originally set up as a 3-year program, specifically temporary, it says that in the statute, with the expectation that in 3 years the private market would have better terrorism models and more capacity and be able to come in and start offering wider terrorism coverage. Obviously, the judgment in 2005 and 2007 was that this had not yet occurred, which is why we had in 2007 a 7-year reauthorization, which, as Eric mentioned, ends at the end of 2014. But it started out with much lower deductibles, with a 7% deductible instead of a 20% deductible. The original split was 90-10, not 85-15. The mandatory recoupment amount started at $10 billion, not at $27.5 billion. And over the time, they've also pulled a few commercial property lines out of the coverage. So the broad scope since it was enacted has been essentially less government participation, increased private participation. The only exception to this is in the 2007 Act, it was originally only aimed at foreign acts of terrorism. And I think that there was concern about, obviously, how do you define foreign? If you have an al-Qaeda cell that operates in the United States that is mixed citizens and non-citizens, is that a foreign act of terrorism? So the 2007 Act basically removed that so that now it covers all acts of terrorism. And I think the one thing that I probably would want to mention before I close is one of the issues that's always struck me is questions of nuclear, chemical, biological attacks. Because as in so many insurance contracts, the devil is in the details of specifically what is covered and what is not covered. The way the program is structured is basically it follows what the private carriers are covering. So it covers insured losses. What that means, though, is that if the commercial insurance that's being offered, it has an exclusion for a nuclear or a chemical attack, and that's what you have as a terrorist attack, this would not be covered under TRIA. And I think it's significant because when you think about the kinds of numbers that we're talking about, when you start talking about terrorist attacks in the billions of dollars, everybody's mind sort of goes to, okay, what happens, you have a chemical attack, a biological attack, a nuclear attack in New York, you can think of reaching $100 billion pretty quickly. Unless the private insurers are covering that when it happens, that coverage would not necessarily happen under TRIA. So you can easily see an opportunity or the possibility of a very large attack which wouldn't fall under the TRIA umbrella because, as I said, the focus is on insured losses. And I think with that I'll close. So we try to leave some time for questions at the end, and I'll be happy to answer any that come up. Thank you.
Let's see if I pass the technology test here. Yeah. There we go. Make it up afterwards. Well, immediately after the tragic attacks of 9/11, I was tasked on the House Financial Services Committee with developing a federal safety net to keep the insurance markets functioning. And within weeks, what became known as TRIA was pushed through the House, and the following year eventually became law. Now, in 2001, our goal was to give underwriters 2 to 3 years to recover their surplus, to price and diversify and model terrorism exposure, and then hopefully the marketplace would return to normal. By 2004, most insurers had been able to geographically diversify their terrorism exposure, but terrorism still threatened our country, and we began to realize that terrorism risk was largely uninsurable. not so much because of a theoretic lack of industry capacity, but because the likelihood and severity and distribution of terrorism attacks are insufficiently predictable. So with TRIA nearing its expiration, the vast majority of significant commercial policies were being filed and used with conditional terrorism exclusions. That meant no TRIA coverage, if TRIA were not reauthorized. And so at that point, the political dynamics also shifted, and the increasing political push for TRIA's renewal came from the commercial policyholders and consumers. Now, while the program was initially a Republican creation in 2001, by 2004, Democratic support had solidified, but Republicans were increasingly divided. House members ultimately agreed to continue the program, but with a long-term phase-out. The Senate didn't want anything long-term, so we ended up compromising on a short-term, one-time, narrowed extension. Now, in 2007, members recognized that the terrorist threat was unlikely to ever return to normal, and members agreed to a long-term extension with few major changes beyond broadening the coverage to include domestic terrorism. And the extension passed the House overwhelmingly, 360 in support, only 53 against, but notably, one of those against was Representative Hensarling, who is now chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. TRIA continues to have strong political support generally, but it's very difficult to move legislation through the House without the agreement of the chairman of the Committee of Jurisdiction, and Chairman Hensarling has yet to be convinced. Also, a significant percentage of members in both the House and the Senate, and even more of the staff, are new since 2007. And not only are they new, but in general they suffer from bailout fatigue from all of the recent federal assistance programs throughout the financial crisis. Now, TRIA is not merely a stimulus program. It's even more important as a national security safety net to protect economic activity before and after an event. And unlike federal programs designed to assist affected industry, a critical point is that TRIA only applies with respect to attacks designed to coerce United States civilians or to influence the policy or conduct of the United States. So, in essence, it protects against a failure of U.S. terrorism interdiction. But this process to help members and staff understand the program and understand its very limited scope with respect to national security will take time, and clearly congressional leaders are in no rush to move forward. Some other new elements in the political mix for 2013, this will be the first TRIA bill involving the Obama administration, which last year reversed the longstanding Treasury call for narrowing TRIA in the administration's budget. I think that's very important. Congress and Treasury will now be advised by a new federal insurance office with a director who is not only from the president's home state but testified in support of TRIA in the last cycle, Director McGrath. And a top emerging national security concern of the administration at numerous levels is the cybersecurity risk, for which insurance and perhaps TRIA may play a major role in strengthening our country's private cybersecurity defenses. To the timing, insurance and reinsurance policies will be negotiated in late 2013 that will extend beyond the current TRIA backstop. Now, even after the catastrophic 9/11 losses, it took until late November 2002 before TRIA was enacted, and it forced insurers to offer coverage, but at that time there were no implementing regulations, no compliance guidance in place, so extensive chaos. Towards the end of 2004, with TRIA nearing its expiration at the end of 2005, commercial insurers started to file and use conditional terrorism exclusions on a significant majority of the commercial policies. But even so, our leaders waited until December 22, 2005 to enact the reauthorization, and the same nightmare was repeated again the next go-around when it was not reauthorized until December 26, 2007, again, a year after the marketplace had already been negotiating and filing policies, leaving consumers and insurers in the lurch and lenders uncertain whether their assets were protected. Now, I've talked in the past to both the House and Senate Republican Democratic staff, literally begging them to make decisions on TRIA at least 15 months in advance to provide some marketplace certainty. They recognize that fact, but the House committee chairman has indicated that he intends to do a lot of listening this year. And if the past is at all predictive of the future, a timely TRIA reauthorization is unlikely. Now, despite all the political machinations, TRIA itself has worked exceptionally well for the last decade. It's cost taxpayers essentially nothing. Consumers have generally been able to purchase available and affordable terrorism insurance coverage. The government protects its national and economic well-being. And the marketplace is made resilient with a well-structured system that helps stabilize the economy should an attack occur. But the TRIA skeptics in Congress have made it very clear they want to discuss reforms to the program to decrease government involvement, and they've dug up a number of memos from 2007, which I drafted on staff, discussing all the various knobs and dials that you can twist in TRIA to make some changes. So some of those past proposals have included changing deductibles, perhaps at the reset after an event, providing separate deductibles for different lines of coverage or for the nuclear, biological, chemical, radiological risks, adjusting the program triggers, perhaps a sliding co-share or requiring private sector pooling. But each of these proposals has fundamental flaws. High triggers squeeze out participation by smaller insurers. The insurer deductibles are already excessive, likely resulting in a market contraction if insurers have a bad base year plus a 20% plus of their revenues from a TRIA loss. While many of them may remain technically solvent, and numbers would have their credit ratings downgraded below acceptable commercial levels. Directing insurers to collect, reserve, and pool terrorism charges over time, something that Tom and I have worked on several proposals to do, could slowly transition TRIA into the private sector. And while a number of these proposals have passed the committee and the House, what we've seen is tying up capital pre-event can be more costly and inefficient than post-event funding, and it's unlikely to ever completely eliminate the need for some sort of federal smoothing mechanism for the most catastrophic events. Tom and I both also worked on and passed TRIA bills, a special mechanism to address the MBCR risks. A similar discussion is now occurring in some sectors over the emerging catastrophic cyber terrorism risks that I think will receive special attention this go-around. Now, since the 2004 reauthorization, it's become clear that the primary beneficiaries of TRIA are the insurance consumers. They've increasingly become the most visible face of the reauthorization effort. PCI has conducted focus groups on how to help consumers and policymakers understand TRIA. Opposition to TRIA in our polling appears primarily centered among the relatively anti-government conservatives. However, even this group becomes much more supportive as they consider that the program has had little to no cost to taxpayers, that TRIA protects the economy both before and after an attack, and the absence of TRIA would be bad for the economy. Now, some of the circumspect congressional staff have told us they want hard data accompanying any TRIA arguments. Fortunately, we have the facts as well as the theory on our side. A 2004 study by economist Glenn Hubbard found that without TRIA, you'd have significantly less private capital available for terrorism. Commercial policyholders would face steep price increases, or in some cases would be wholly unable to obtain coverage. And this would slow economic recovery and job growth in the United States. It would cause a GDP loss of 0.4%. Household net worth declines of 0.9% and 0.2% fewer jobs created. These are significant economic losses relative to a program that has cost taxpayers essentially nothing since its inception. Now, according to the Independent Government Accountability Office, TRIA has enhanced the availability of terrorism insurance for commercial policyholders. Prior to TRIA, GAO had reported concern that some development projects had been delayed or canceled because of the unavailability of terrorism coverage. They conveyed the widespread concern that general economic growth and development would be slowed by a lack of available terrorism insurance, and they found that largely because of TRIA, these problems no longer appear to be major concerns. And finally, from GAO, although insurers and some reinsurers had cautiously re-entered the terrorism risk market to cover insurers' remaining exposures, they heard that no progress to date had been made toward finding a reliable method for pricing terrorism insurance, and little progress towards any mechanism that would enable insurers to provide terror insurance to businesses without government involvement. And we're now updating these factual analyses. Ultimately, as fiscal conservatives dig deeper into TRIA, they appreciate that TRIA hasn't cost taxpayers a penny in payments, requires the private sector to keep significant skin in the game before and after an event, really a strong fiscal responsibility message. TRIA is only triggered in a truly catastrophic loss targeted against the United States, and TRIA has a recoupment mechanism that Baird described to repay most federal expenditures that could occur. And TRIA really saves the taxpayers from emptying the Treasury to compensate injured victims if an event were to occur, which we often see in cases where no insurance exists. Now, while the expiration of TRIA could result in some degree of very expensive additional marginal private sector terrorism capacity, that amount is dwarfed by the private sector capital withdrawn from the marketplace through conditional exclusions in the past had TRIA expired. So truly, TRIA brings in much more private capital than would exist without the program. Finally, for those who have suggested that terrorism is somehow a regional problem, not only do the vast majority of Americans recognize that terrorism is a national security issue of concern to all citizens, but in fact, as this map shows, terrorism attacks have been attempted all across the nation in almost all regions. In fact, remember that the second largest successful terrorist attack in the United States was in Oklahoma City. So the Terrorist Risk Insurance Act is a critical national security system concerned to all Americans, one of the better designed private sector-based taxpayer protection programs, despite my past involvement. Congress, I believe, will get there, but it's going to be very challenging and expected to be very late. So, thank you.